This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm excited to have here in the studio with me M.L. Liebler, a Detroit-based poet, professor of English at Wayne State University. He's the author of the prize-winning poetry collection, Wide Awake in Someone Else's Dream. I love that title. And he just published a really impressive anthology, 500 pages and more, called Working Words, Punching the Clock, and Kicking Out the Jams. M.L. Liebler, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hey, it's great to be here, man.
It's great to meet you. Tell me a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up, I was raised by my grandparents. My grandfather was, an auto worker. They used to have those in Detroit back then. Now my students don't know what that is. But he worked for Ford for a number of years and was fired after a while because he was driving a Dodge to work.
Really?
Yeah, and things were different. So he thought, well, okay, I'll go to Dodge and work then because I have a Dodge. It was an old beat-up car, just to get to work.
I heard about firing people for foreign cars, but I didn't realize if you got fired.
Well, this was a long time ago, and they would go through the parking lot. And if they saw back then, if they saw now a foreign car, but back then if they saw a car that wasn't a Ford, and he worked there about 14 years. I mean, it was a while. So anyway, he went to Dodge, Maine, and ended up working 33 years. But he was there for the sit-down of 1937. Mm-hmm. So, which Chrysler Dodge, Maine was the first Detroit area after Flint factory that went, that had it. And they had about 10,000 workers at that time. So,
so working class activism comes naturally to you.
Well, it does in a way. That's another part of the story. My grandfather was just a working class guy, a lunch bucket guy. I mean, he knew the union was right because he'd seen what happens when you don't have one, and he'd worked for Chrysler, before that too. But, he didn't really come home and, wearing union buttons or anything like that. The only time, and he was a very quiet man anyway, the only time he really sort of came alive in that sense, and I had never really thought to ask him about that before, but I tried to organize workers at Sears when I worked there. And we finally got cards signed and we had the election, of which we were crushed, because they had all these little old ladies that they were, buying breakfast for every day. I know little old ladies, some of them are my best friends, and yours too. But they would buy them breakfast, and they thought Sears was the greatest place to work. So in the end, we had the election, which was a tough fought campaign. But we ended up, they voted something like 3,000 to 10 not to have the union. But it was hard. It was a hard struggle to do that. And that's my grandfather. I remember my grandmother saying, what are you encouraging him for? He's going to get fired. And he said, this is serious business. I remember that. I'm getting goosebumps just remembering that conversation. So it was that kind of a home, just working class people living a working class existence. And activism probably creeped into me. But they had to there because he did tell me they started to build weapons with the because they were, they thought the military or the militia was going to come in, the National Guard.
This at 37.
Yeah. Yeah, so he said they started to make weapons out of what they could because, they were expecting them to come in.
And this was with the Ruther brothers? Were they there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was definitely. And in those days, too, like Ruther, those guys all knew them. It wasn't like they were superstars. They were the guys, especially Victor.
I met Victor once, and he was quite a storyteller, too.
Oh, yeah.
And an impressive guy, but he must have been 85 when I
talked to him.
Yeah, it was many years ago.
He was. Doug Frazier, who came in later, of course, but he was on faculty. I teach in the labor studies program, too. So I don't know how much of a part I'll play in this new ruling that you guys probably heard about where all labor studies departments, they got a FOIA request at Michigan State, Wayne State.
I didn't realize that.
And U of M that they want all... You guys, it's all your fault. They want all emails written by labor faculty or anyone associated with it, which I'm one, that have in the heading. Didn't you hear about this?
I heard about,
in the heading,
I heard about the Wisconsin professor.
Walker, Wisconsin, Madison, or Maddow. If that's anywhere in the heading of the email or the emails about collective bargaining, this conservative group funded by the Koch brothers, has put out a FOIA, and I just happened to walk into the Labor Study Director's office to talk about this program related to this we're having next week in Detroit. And he said he was on the phone. They were interviewing, calling him from all over the country. And he passed me that piece of paper. He said, "Here, you can take this." So I did, and I made copies for all my students. And
are you guys going to fight it, or do you have to cough up the emails?
Well, you know, they didn't ask me to look for any. I don't use Wayne State's email for that reason. I mean, who knew it was going to come to this with your governor at some point, but and ours too. But I just never liked using their email anyway. Just, I don't know what it was. Maybe I had another sense that someday they might want stuff because they own it. Because my students were saying, "Does that mean they own our email too?" And I said, "Yeah, if you're using their email, they own it. You know, it's government property." So
what do you make of this kind of witch hunt that's happening?
Well, it's starting to make the Michigan thing, look even more deceptive and evil than what's happening here. We were just talking briefly in the car on the way over. Is your governor? He looks like an idiot. Can I say that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he looks like a shyster and an idiot, as my grandmother would have called him. And so you see him, he's the guy you see, you know, in your class or walking down the street and you just say, "Look at that guy, you know, that guy's got a problem." Our guy is different. He's very nice. And in fact, his 10-point program, if I might quote the Black Panther Party in reverse, was like, the first one was like, say nice things about Michigan. And I've read those to my students, like, here's the top 10 or his plan, because everyone kept saying, "What's your plan?" He didn't do any debates. He refused even Republican debates. He did, "I'm not doing them. Homie doesn't do them." But he wasn't kind of that attitude. But he didn't do them, and then he had this 10-point plan. Just look on my website. And they were stuffed literally, like, say nice things about Michigan, have a more optimistic outlook about the future. And there was nothing concrete, like, we'll do this and we'll move this and nothing. And so when he's on TV now, he's doing all this really bizarre stuff. But he looks happy. He looks like your banker.
But he's
without a tie.
He signed this bill where he can privatize every public town and county.
We had a union meeting that day, and part of the union meeting with the faculty union was to right on the spot, everyone pull your cell phones out and call, you know, your congresspeople in Lansing, and we all did that. Now, fortunately for me, they're Democrats, and they were on board with it in my area. But, you know, others. And then while we were doing it, the snooty head Republican guy, they called his office and they told us it passed. We were still kind of, some were still on the phone, you know, and he signed it. Yeah. So that's what's more evil in a way. Because that can, I don't know, we can't get into the ramifications of all that. But basically, he can assign somebody who anyone can apply for that job, you know, for emergency manager. It's nothing special. And that person can come in and just get rid of the city council, the mayor, destroy all contracts, ignore all contracts with labor, and do what he or she thinks is best for that community.
It's just shocking. I'm speaking with M.L. Liebler, a Detroit-based poet and professor of English at Wayne State. What's the fight back been to this in Michigan? We've had this huge fight back in Wisconsin, obviously.
Well, you know, that's what I'm wondering. It's been big. You know, I was over in England, actually, when they had one of the two. And then I read on the internet the next day what the situation was. And they mentioned something like, a few thousand. And I thought, well, you know, Michigan, this isn't going to do it. But and I'm friends with Michael Moore, and you probably heard about this. He was rallying, and he had emailed me to rally people too for the next day in Lansing, and I again was in Liverpool actually. That one was big, and that's when they went in and did a little version of your thing where they took over the Capitol and protested inside as well as outside. So that gave me hope. Now the other thing that gives me hope, if we can catch the wind of what's going on here. Is we can bring our governor up for a recall in June. So
that's soon.
Yeah. It's a different law.
Well, you're lucky. We got to wait till November.
I know you do, but ours is June, and people are already starting the petitions, and the signs are all over. You know, recall Snyder now and stuff. So if the momentum goes, and a lot of people, and it's probably true here, who voted for this guy. you know, they have buyer remorse and they're rethinking it. And, you know, because we had the polls like you had the other day, and if the election were today, Virge Bonero would have won by 2, and which is incredible because this other guy that's in won by about 20 or something like that.
I mean, I've seen signs at the protests in Madison which said, you know, I voted for Walker and I regret it, or I voted Republican my whole life until yesterday. I'm not going to vote Republican again.
Yeah.
So it's been a real consciousness.
Well, this has done it, especially in Michigan, because he went after, you know, the pensioners, the retirees, and who don't understand politics, but they understand money. And so that's really got him going. In fact, I just read on my Kindle this morning, because I came from Paterson, New Jersey, another town destroyed post-industrial. But I was reading on there that a lot of the Republicans now in Michigan, in Lansing, are not going to side with them on this budget. They're all kind of pulling out and, well, you know, because they're getting flack from the senior citizens.
Yeah, there's a price to be paid.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with M.L. Liebler, this poet out of Detroit who teaches English at Wayne State. We're going to start talking a little bit about poetry. He's the author of a prize-winning collection called Wide Awake and Someone Else's Dream, and then this really impressive new anthology called Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams. Tell me about this anthology.
Well, you know, I started teaching a labor studies class at Wayne State, I think in 1991, and it was subtitled Labor Through the Arts. And, of course, we talk, the idea was to teach poetry, stories, film, plays, artwork, painting. Ralph Facinelli was a big part of the class, and the Diego Rivera murals in Detroit and so forth, and the Heidelberg Project and stuff. So, but there was no book. There was a book that had some poetry in it. There was an occasional book that would have a few stories in it, but most of it I had to Xerox and bring into class because I couldn't just say, buy this book, you know, it's got what we need in it. And so I got the idea to put an anthology together. I had two ideas back at that time. One was to put together a labor or working class anthology. It's labor and working class, and we can talk about that. And the other was to put together a Vietnam reader, because I'd been teaching the Vietnam War through literature also at Wayne State is another thing that I do. And there at that time wasn't a book for either, an anthology, a reasonably priced anthology. So, you know, I started working on the labor one, getting the idea for it, and the Vietnam one. But shortly after my thoughts on that, you know, many Vietnam readers came out. In fact, there's a great one by Stuart Onan now called The Vietnam Reader. And that's the one I use in my class. I mean, it's inexpensive like this book. It's got everything, poetry, stories, songs, you name it, memoir. It's, and all the biggies, you know, from Phil Caputo to the guy who is going to retire out in Virginia, Jim Webb. He wrote a famous Fields of Fire, I think. Excerpts of all this stuff is in there, Ron Kovic and all that.
The things they carry that series probably in there too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's all there. Yeah. In fact, that's highlighted. There's certain ones highlighted, Paco's story and so forth. But so that took care of that. But nothing was happening. Nothing was happening. I was still Xeroxing. So I went and I had this idea. And fortunately, you know, I've been a literary activist and organizer for many years. I know a lot of people and worked with a lot of people. So I was bringing a lot of my friends, so to speak, stuff in. This is not an anthology where a call went out. And, you know, this was like there was no money. You know, because it originally was a university press project. They had no permissions. And so that wasn't an issue. I mean, if I'd done it with Random House or something like that, then they would have had a big budget, you know. But there was nothing like that. So how am I going to do this? Well, I'm going to call the people that I use in the class, whom I know, and I'm going to ask them to give their stuff. And that's a big part of this story is everybody in that book is in there gratis and willingly and happy to do it, even some of the dead people. No. Well, some of the older stuff is out of a copyright. But even some of the amazing names that are in there, and everybody is in there, Bob Dylan's in there, and Phil Levine's in there, and Rebecca Harding Davis, and Dorothy Day, and Daniel Berrigan, and Amiri Baraka, and it goes on and on. Well, these are all people that I know and I've worked with. So when I call them, they were fine with it, you know, and they did it for the cause. One, it was a university press at that time. And so everybody, the Dylan part was funny. I mean, Michael.
How did that work? How did the Dylan part work?
Well, the Dylan part worked. I'm friends with Al Cooper, and who's also in it. You know, the organ player from the early days, and he's friends with Bob and Jeff Rosen, who runs things. I always give all praise to Jeff Rosen, and he told him. Al talked to Jeff and said, you know, ML's doing this book. He'd like to have Bob Dylan. Now, I only wanted originally the last thoughts on Woody Guthrie. That was the idea. Within minutes of that conversation, I get a call from Jeff Rosen, and he says, and he talked to Bob, like people do that, I guess. He talked to Bob, and he said, Bob said you could have anything you want gratis. Wow. And I, so I'm sitting at my desk at my office at Wayne, and I said, well, okay, can I have The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll? Yeah. Last Thoughts of Woody? Yeah. Anything else? Union Sundown? Yeah. Anything else? And I couldn't, I couldn't think fast enough. But that was okay. That was a good sampling of the things I'd wanted if I could have. And Jeff came through.
The Union Sundown one is a real part of Union Sundown.
Yeah, I've read that at readings for this book. We've had readings all over the country, and they've always had a lot of people. You know, wherever we are in the country, where those people, like out west, Wanda's joined us and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's the story. Everybody went in. And then the press freaked out because Oxford University Press was going to publish a working class anthology. And this press at the university said, oh, my goodness, we cannot compete with Oxford University. And I said, well, ours is a different thing. It's a more localized. It's affordable, you know, and because Oxford would make a textbook, which they did, and it is about $70 now, and nobody buys it. And so I told them, don't worry about it. But they worried about that, and they thought we can't compete with it. But anyway, Coffee House was the best place. And word was on the street that Alan Kornblum, who runs Coffee House, was interested. And finally, I got a contract from somebody else, and I sent an email to Coffee House, and I said, I keep hearing you guys are interested. I'm not hearing anything. You know, better say something. Like in minutes, literally, Alan Kornblum called and said, don't sign anything. And I said, well, fine, you know. And we had a long conversation. The contract was just like the spirit of this book. It was just done on the phone. You know, and I had everything. I had all the permissions signed. Everybody was on board. And Coffee House is a nonprofit. So I thought to roll it over wouldn't be a big deal. And it wasn't with anybody. Nobody said, well, wait a minute, how much am I going? Nobody said anything like that. It was like, good, this goes to help and highlight the working class in literature because there was nothing like it. And whatever money Coffee House did, just put it back into publishing authors. So it's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The book is called Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams, edited by M.L. Liebler, who's right here with me. We were just talking about that Dylan Union Sundown, the chorus of which is, well, it's sundown on the Union, and what's made in the USA sure was a good idea till greed got in the way.
Yeah, that's so, right. That's right. Yeah, it's a great, great one.
And I'd like you to, you've got a poem in there called Making It Right, which I'd love it if you'd read.
Okay. I'll do that. This is in my, that's in that book, and it's in my book before that. This is a poem that I do travel around the world quite a bit, and this is a lesson. I'm sure there are young writers out there listening, or any writers, because they always ask me, how do you go all around the world and stuff like that? Well, whatever people ask you to do, within reason, you just say yes, and then you figure it out. So I had been doing stuff in Germany, and somebody asked me to come over and give a talk on labor in Detroit and Chicago during the Depression. Can you do that? And I said, absolutely. I mean, I teach labor studies, but not Chicago. Detroit, I know. But then I thought, well, I don't want to go over there and give it. I'm not a lecturing kind of guy, you know. So I wrote this poem on the plane, and that's how I started my program. I had video clips of the time and era and stuff. And I started with this, and this is the poem. It's called Making It Right, and I use Phil Levine, my friend and great Detroit poet. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is. Although you may not do it, forget you. I bring no poetry today from the oil and grease soul of my Detroit. This history I am is only and nothing more than the son of an auto worker. Just another Detroit man beaten down by the tortured years of depression, world wars, and the awful angst of unemployment. This is my story without balance, weighing heavier on the side of heartache and less on the side of the sacred and glorious. This is my story of what no work is and what it can do to the working class and the darkness of our desperation. I wish now I did have some kind of little poem to say aloud right here to make you all understand what is inside the blackened heart and under the whittled bones of the people who have been left behind in the ashes of the plant. I guess I could read you a poem about how labor takes a boy and makes him a worker before he's allowed to become a man, how the factory humiliates and intimidates all people with endless assembly and useless work, how the line takes 1 ounce of every soul live for every minute it is sped up to completion, how Henry Ford's great innovation doomed generations to continuous monotony in the name of making a living. But I'm afraid that I can only bring the small news of what becomes of people who work hard with greasy hands, about people who learn that their reality is having their names spelled out in factory smoke long before they were born, a birthright for workers to endure through the long loneliness of industry and unemployment lines where we wait and wait for our bread and roses to fall from the sky like beads of perspiration upon our graves. We dream that maybe prosperity is really just around the corner. So we get up every morning with hope and we return each night to the broken houses of our lives, seldom realizing that it is our labor that keeps this whole world together. I guess in the end we do not know what work is, but still we continue to do it over and over and over, making it right.
That's M.L. Liebler reading the poem entitled Making It Right. I love that poem.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I love that line about the small news of what becomes of people.
Well, that's what I wrote on that plane. It's a long flight. So I kept thinking of Phil Levine's What Work Is, and then it dawned on me, you know, because you know these kind of intellectuals that come to hear about workers. There's probably a few of them around here.
You write in your introduction to this great book, Working Words, Punching the Clock and Kicking Out the Jams, of the very important role that art plays in the working class. What is that role?
Well, you know, art, on one level, intellectuals might look at it or academies might look at it and say, well, you know, working class, what do they know about art? But when you really study it or look a little closer at it, art has been always affiliated with the working class and with labor, organized labor. It's always made it. I mean, what do we do? What did you guys do? You sang songs. You probably had some poets standing around with megaphones too,
and fun signs,
and fun art.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some was left on some of the buildings around as well. So you know, it's always had that role. So my idea was to break that down and just kind of say it out loud. That, you know, there's great poems and songs and stories that are all working class by nature and what they're dealing with. And in fact, one critic, the only place that gave it sort of a weird review was they said that it wasn't the Progressive that said, and they said it was the antithesis of that. They said that it was that, you know, the book was, you know, about people who lived in trailer parks and were drinking and there was some a domestic abuse. And they said, this is a caricature of the working class. And I'm thinking, dude, where are you from, man? You know, this is what, and that's what that book is. It's not all about people working on a line or working in their jobs. A lot of it is, but it's about what goes on in the houses of and behind the doors of working class people in all areas, women, men, transgendered, you know, gay, lesbian. You know, it's all part of our collective story.
And some of it is grim, but a lot of it's affirming too. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about the collection. There's just a huge range. I mean, you got everyone from, you know, Emily Dickinson to
Now that's one Dillon. I always say she didn't work a day in her life, but she watched somebody work, a blacksmith, and she wrote a poem about it. But yeah, maybe that's something to tell people who are just listening to this is that the book has a collection of poems in it. It has stories in it. and it has a memoir or you know, what do you call it, creative nonfiction. So it's kind of, and it had plays originally. I had Amiri Baraka's great mm-hmm. play, The Lone Ranger, and what is it, something about the mass production. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he gave that to me. I had Cliff Odets in it. And since we moved out of the play when it became a coffee house book, I kept him in the fiction part as a story. It's one of his plays he wrote for Strikers.
Right, and you got Baraka poem in here too.
Yeah, and I got Baraka's. I had his poem in anyway. Right. So,
well, why don't you read? We don't have a ton of time left. Mm-hmm. One more poem from you that's not in the collection, but I love the poem. It's in Wide Awake in Someone Else's Dream. And it's called Outsourcing.
Outsourcing. We know about that in Detroit. I had an idea recently. Genius, I thought. I would disassemble the factory of myself, break it all down, and ship the most valuable parts to some other places. To do this, I had to carefully detach each wire and bolt and secretly unscrew me from me as not to grab anyone's attention or curiosity. For example, while my foot was asleep, I sent all of my memories south. While my scalp prickled with beads of sweat, I sent my love north to cool. And later, while my brain was entranced with commercials on television, I sent those mysterious 21 grams of my soul, which I read about in Time magazine, straight out of this world, way further than Mexico, China, Pakistan, or anywhere anyone has ever heard of. Gone, vanished, just like that. When all was said and done, very little of the old me was left. Yes, I had my ever-growing fingernails and toenails, the occasional annoying hidden body rashes here and there, and of course, plenty of those middle-aged hairs growing in my ears and nose. But the substance? What was the substance anyway? Suddenly it occurred to me the other day that when I gave all of me away, what remained was just another abandoned factory. And that's no way to run a life.
That's M.L. Liebler reading Outsourcing, which is in his collection Wide Awake in Someone Else's Dreams. We've got a couple minutes left. Sure. Do you enjoy teaching at Wayne State? What are your students like?
Yeah, I've been there 32 years now. I love teaching at Wayne State. Wayne State is a working class school in the middle of Detroit, kind of like City College might be in New York. The students, even though their fathers don't or mothers don't work in factories nowadays, they're still working class kids. There's a whole set of morals and ethics that go with the working class, and that's what I'm talking about and was looking for in those poems and stories. So my students are like that. Many of them are first-time college students, which I was too. And I know what that struggle is, and it's hard sometimes for them.
And it's probably getting harder.
And it's getting harder, and I tell them that you know, there are people in power who would like to see you go away for all kinds of reasons. So I just sent a kid an email from New York this morning and said, you know, look, come back. You know, don't drop, because I'll get you through this. You know, we'll work through this.
And how do they respond to knowing that there are people out there in power who don't want them to be there?
They're just becoming aware of it. They're just becoming aware of it. It's kind of a new thing. So, you know, and I don't talk about it. I mean, I'm an English professor or an English teacher. I can talk about it in labor class, but, you know, I don't like to go on and on. I'm very much against, you know, infiltrating their minds.
Right, but that's kind of a rude message for them to receive, and they're receiving it all over the place from these Republican corporatists.
Yeah, they're getting it.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. My guest this week has been M.L. Liebler. He is the author of a great poetry collection called Wide Awake in Someone Else's Dream, and a really impressive anthology I can't recommend enough, Working Words, Punching the Clock, and Kicking Out the Jams.
It's out there everywhere.
It's a great book. M.L. Liebler, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.